So I'm Doug Thorpe, and this class is Treasures in the Back Streets, Exploring Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov. And this is day one, Digressions and Buried Treasure. And the treasure theme, of course, is the theme here at Holden this summer. And so I want to play a little bit with that. That will come up strongly tomorrow in particular, but this notion of back streets, back ways, digressions, this is everywhere in the novel. Dostoevsky, people who complain about Dostoevsky say that as an author, he's what Henry James described Dostoevsky's novels as loose, baggy monsters. And the idea was that they just kind of meander all over the place. And if you like a tight framework, you're going to get very frustrated with Dostoevsky's narrative. He loves to just digress. And one of the key questions that we have this week is, okay, what makes for a digression? What is a digression? What is it to go off the topic or off the subject? And is it true? Is it not true, sometimes at least, that when we think we're on a digression, it turns out that that was actually the path. That's where we were supposed to be, even though it feels like a detour of some sort. Many of you who've traveled have probably had that experience. If you have stuck to the itinerary completely all through Europe in 3 weeks and had no digressions, you're probably not. Not fun. I mean, it's safe. There's a sense of control and security and so on. But it's those side trips. You know, you see something down that way, and you go, maybe you get a little bit lost. And so that's Dostoevsky. He loves to take us on those side trips. I do have handouts. And I would ask that when we finish each day, that if you would return the handout, because they are all stapled together, and this is the packet for the week. And if I don't get them back, I won't have any for tomorrow, and then we'll really just be one. Unless you are absolutely certain you're going to be here tomorrow, if you are, then you can keep the handout and read tomorrow's sections. Otherwise, I would ask that you return. Okay, Brothers Karamazov. A brief background on Dostoevsky himself and the times, which I think are going to be important. Born 1821.
Thank you.
You are welcome. You're welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
19th century Russia, 19th century Europe, time of major upheavals. If you think Dostoevsky was born 1821 in the 1840s, he would be in his 20s. A major time of transition, of growth and development. He's already finding himself as a novelist. He wrote a fairly well-received book in 1845 called Poor Folk. It was a fairly realistic novel. Politically, it was a time of great upheaval. Think about 1848 in Europe, major revolutionary events going on in 1848. A lot of that energy was true in Russia as well. By the late 1840s, Dostoevsky's getting involved in some underground radical political movements. That are interested in, one, freeing the serfs, which actually happened in 1862. There's this amazing parallel between Russia and the United States in this way, and I think in lots of ways. And so just as almost within a couple of years of the Emancipation Proclamation, the Tsar is freeing the serfs. And so there was this desire for some kind of increased democracy, and the most extreme was to depose the Tsar himself, just as in France and the French Revolution, of course, you have that going on. So Dostoevsky gets very involved in these movements, these revolutionary movements. And these movements, primarily young people, interested in, to put it really optimistically and positively, interested in finding ways to bring prosperity, to bring freedom, to bring liberty, to bring knowledge to all the people. The strong kind of democratic movement. The Tsar was not particularly excited about this idea. Dostoevsky and this whole group of revolutionaries are arrested, 1849, and sentenced to death. The pivotal moment in Dostoevsky's life, you could say. He is sentenced to death, sentenced to be shot in front of a firing squad. And He is actually with his fellow revolutionaries. There's a group of them that are lined up. And the first one is literally facing the firing squad when a horse and a rider come galloping up, and there's an announcement made that the Tsar, in his mercy, has granted, has commuted their sentences to a certain number of years in Siberia. Right. What we know is, welcome, and there are some handouts here.
Sorry.
That's all right.
You're trying to sneak.
That's all right. It's all right. I will count you as light, and that will, you know, you will be docked. You're going to have to present tomorrow. On the next 400 pages. You thought you were going to do something else up here at Holden, didn't you? Other than Major Brothers Scaramanzo. You were wrong.
Can we borrow your book?
Yeah, you might want to pick up the comic book, you know, the smaller version.
Cliff Notes and the Cliff Notes.
Oh, he will sell it to me. I cannot tell you how often I make the mistake of asking my students how far they've actually gotten in reading. And they're pretty honest with me, actually, which is terrible. Well, I just want them to say, oh, I finished it. So here you have a group of people facing a firing squad, and the Tsar, out of the mercy of his heart, commutes his sentence to Siberia. Now, this is all PR. It was all PR. The Tsar had never had any intention of killing these men. It was just to, you know, it was a media event, essentially. Now, 1849 media event. One of those individuals literally went insane from that. I mean, you can imagine. And Dostoevsky was third or fourth in line. So he is there anticipating within about 3 minutes that he's going to be shot. And instead, he gets a new lease on life. And for Dostoevsky, this traumatic experience actually was transformative for him. He went to Siberia and was something of a non-believer when he went, and came out of Siberia some years later having had something of a conversion experience, some kind of real transformative experience up there, in part because he was not with the kind of, he was sort of lower aristocrat, family, but he was there with mostly, think about the population of our prisons today. And it was poor, it was, you know, working class folks. And this is who Dostoevsky was meeting. And it was like he was living the gospel in some way. So he comes out of that experience, is finally allowed to return to St. Petersburg, and continues to write. And of course, it is subsequent to that experience that what we think of the great novel. Crime and Punishment, the first one, The Idiot, wonderful novel, Possessed, which is about revolutionary movements in Russia, and finally, The Brothers Karamazov, 1879, 1880. Right at the end of his life, he dies in 1881. 1881, the Tsar is assassinated. So same year Dostoevsky dies, shortly after the publication. I mention this because one of the things I really want to underscore, and one reason I love teaching this novel is because Dostoevsky himself obviously went through a profoundly radical experience as a young man. And by the late 1870s, he was watching another group of youth growing up in Russia, looking for some kind of meaning, some kind of truth, and having a hard time finding it. He also had a profound sense that Russia was on the verge of absolute crisis. And he felt the world was on the verge of crisis. And again, it was a question, where is this going to go? The late 1800s, you've got, of course, publication of Darwin's Evolution, Evolution Theories, Origin of Species. You've got a strong group of people in Russia, as in Europe, who are what would be called, for Dostoevsky, sort of an old liberal set, who had been influenced by the French Revolution, influenced by European ideas, influenced by scientific theories, influenced by rationalism, a strong sense that, well, if we want to create a just society, if we want to find a way to bring about healing and change for our society, How are we going to do that? The answer was primarily through rational methods. It was through the law. It was through democracy. I mean, we're talking about the founding of our country, of course, as well, coming out of an Enlightenment background, Jefferson and so on. A strong sense that we can create a just society through our own human means. There was a strong movement in Russia in that same direction. So there's this group of people. There's also a strong conservative group of people who were supportive of the church hierarchy and of the Tsar. And that group tended to be also very repressive. So there was strong censorship that Dostoevsky himself was facing. And that repression went so far as to, again, as Dostoevsky himself experienced, imprisonment and possibly a death sentence. So there's this fiercely reactionary group as well. And then you have a group of young folks who are, to a certain extent, all over the map, but some of them were essentially nihilists, meaning that what they believed was that you have to tear the whole bloody system down. You've just got to tear the system down. And then we'll see what materializes. And Dostoevsky had a profound interest in this next generation. He's writing what, and he essentially knows he's coming towards the end of his life. He's been ill. And so the Brothers Karamazov is his, in some ways, grand experiment to think about, okay, there are all these different possible ways to bring about the transformation of a society. How do we do it? Where does healing come from? Where does healing come from? And I'm following right on the heels of the Gospel of John. And the discussion this morning had to do in part with people who are searching, people who are hungry, and they see this man and they follow. Come and see. Come find out for yourself what's here. And so this is where Dostoevsky is taking us, is this grand experiment. All right. And do you folks need copies here?
Please.
So what I want to do is dive in. And as we begin the novel, it is a novel about a family living in a village in Russia, the Karamazov family. The father, Fyodor, is a member of an older generation who is a libertine, is a cynic, is a sensualist, a word that Dostoevsky uses a lot, and in some ways a non-believer.
The name of Theodore? What a name? Theodore?
Fyodor.
Fyodor. Oh.
Fyodor. It's, in English it would be Theodore, but Fyodor. And one of the interesting things, Fyodor, the father, is perhaps the most despicable character in the whole novel. The Dostoevsky's descriptions, he was influenced by, he loved Dickens, and if you've read Dickens, you'll see some of the kind of extraordinarily exaggerated qualities that you get in Dickens show up in Dostoevsky as well. Fyodor is just, it's hard not to hate him. And that's part of the point. I mean, he's really placing us in this character that you just want to annihilate. And his first name is Fyodor. Dostoevsky's first name? Fyodor. So he gives really the most despicable character in his own name. And that is significant. Dostoevsky knew something about himself. He was very difficult, a difficult man in ways. Had a gambling addiction for a number of years, serious gambling addiction, was in poverty much of the time, partly because he took over debts of his brother, but also because of the gambling. He would be traveling. He spent some time out of Russia, in part because he was escaping his creditors. And he would be in one area of Germany. He had to make a trip to Hamburg, and his wife would hand him the equivalent of, let's say, $100, and would say, "This is just enough money to get you on the train back for your hotel and for three meals. That's it. Promise me. Here's the Bible. Promise me on the Bible. You will not go into the gambling hall. You will not go into the casino. I promise. I absolutely promise." Gets on the train, gets to Hamburg, gets off the train, goes right into the gambling hall. blows the entire, I mean, makes $1,000 and then blows the whole thing. And has to wire his wife.
For more money.
More money. Dostoevsky knew something about this incredible cycle. I mean, it's an extreme form of, I think, what we all know something about. There is this incredible sense of falling, of a failure to heal ourselves. That's what he knew in the bottom of his soul, how hard it is to heal ourselves. And so the novel really starts from that awareness of the human condition. So you've got Fyodor, who has no interest, really, in healing ourselves. And Fyodor has three sons. And those three sons are often thought of allegorically, meaning that the eldest, Dmitri, is a soldier and is something of a sensualist himself. Very physical, very body, loves, I mean, Dostoevsky talks about him putting away two bottles of cognac in an hour or two. And if you've ever tasted cognac, I tell my students, it's like, you know, I mean, cognac is a sipping thing. And it's intense stuff. So that's the beginning. Yvonne is the second student, and he is really the intellect. And Alyosha is the youngest, and Alyosha, in some ways, is the heart of the spirit. And I don't want to over-allegorize it because they all share the Karamazov characteristics, if you want to put it that way. The Karamazovs also represent the Russian family, the Russian soul in some ways. That's what Dostoevsky is doing with the Karamazovs. Here is Russia. Here is Fyodor, an older generation, is essentially bankrupt, morally bankrupt. What comes out of that elder generation and that earlier time period? What have we got? We've got three sons who are divided. And there's a possible fourth son, a character named Smerdyakov, who was born illegitimately. And probably Fyodor is the father. And so this is the creation of Fyodor, if you want to put it that way. So we've got this new generation. What are they going to produce? And ultimately, as we'll see if you stick around, you've got, by the end of the novel, another generation. So Dostoevsky is inviting us to look at three generations and saying, okay, is there a way for us actually to transform, to move ahead as a society? So the family and these generations become a microcosm of that. And Dostoevsky calls Alyosha his hero. And he says, it's hard for me to claim him as a hero because he doesn't really do all that much. Kind of simple character. But he's my hero, the third son. There's also a little bit of a sense, if you think about fairy tales, folk tales, how often do you begin a folk tale with, there was a king with three sons? And Dostoevsky is playing on that tradition as well. There's a fairy tale-like quality, there's a fantastic quality, a supernatural quality in certain ways in this novel. Even as it is a deeply realistic novel. That is, it's a town, these are actual characters, this is not science fiction, this is not fantasy. And Dostoevsky is writing in a context where realism, naturalism, this is what reality is. It's what's right in front of us. It's our physical bodies, it's our mind, and so on. As opposed to the supernatural, the miraculous. And so Dostoevsky takes the novel tradition, which is a realistic tradition, and also wants to suggest that in the middle of realism, in the middle of our ordinary lives, there is somewhere present the miraculous, if you are looking for it. This is that treasure, right, that's buried in a field or in the back alley or wherever. We can experience it right here in the midst of ourselves. It's not somewhere. And Alyosha is really the carrier of that treasure in some ways. So let's, we're in this passage that does, the first passage of your handout, chapter 4, book 1. We are being introduced to Alyosha. So would somebody read, those of you who have young eyes and can read relatively small print, If somebody would just start reading where we pick up, he was then only 20 years old, up to about five or six lines down on good narrative voice. Thank you.
He was then only 20 years old. His brother Ivan was in his 24th year, and our elder brother Dmitri was going on 28. First of all, I announce that this young man, Alyosha, was not at all a fanatic, and in my view at least, even not at all a mystic. I will give my full opinion beforehand. He was simply an early lover of mankind. And if he threw himself into the monastery path, it was only because it alone struck him at the time and presented him, so to speak, with an ideal way out for his soul, struggling from the darkness of worldly wickedness towards the light of love. And this path struck him only because on it, at that time, he met a remarkable being, in his opinion, our famous monastery elder, Sosima, to whom he became attached with all the ardent first love of his unquenchable heart. However, I do not deny that he was, at that time, already very strange, having been so even from the cradle. Incidentally, I have already mentioned that although he lost his mother in his fourth year, he remembered her afterwards all his life, her face, her caresses, as if she were standing alive before me. Such memories can be remembered, everyone knows this, even from an earlier age, even from the age of two, but they only emerge throughout one's life as specks of light, as it were, against the darkness, as a corner torn from a huge picture, which has all faded and disappeared except for that little corner. That is exactly how it was with him. He remembered a quiet summer evening, an open window, the slanting rays of the setting sun, the slanting rays he remembered most of all, an icon in the corner of the room, a lighted oil lamp in front of it, and before the icon, on her knees, his mother, sobbing as if in hysterics, with shrieks and cries, seizing him in her arms, hugging him so tightly that it hurt, and pleading for him to the Mother of God, holding him out from her embrace with both arms towards the icon, as if under the protection of the Mother of God. And suddenly a nurse rushes in and snatches him from her in fear. What a picture! Alyosha remembered his mother's face, too, at that moment. He used to say that it was frenzied, but beautiful, as far as he could remember.
Okay, we'll stop there. All right, so that gives you a slice of Dostoevsky's style. Anything stand out? Anything catch your eye? Any sense of the narrator here? Who is a character in his own life?
You say it was very strange, even from the cradle.
Yeah, so the narrator is telling us, he's telling us two different things. I mean, on the one hand, well, I don't want you to get the idea that Alyosha was a fanatic. And not even a mystic, although he's in the monastery. He's gone off to the monastery. And so he is speaking to an audience, and Dostoevsky has been quite explicit about speaking, the narrator is speaking to the current generation. He's speaking to his fellow Russians. So he wants to say, well, you know, it's like if you had somebody you knew who'd gone off to the monastery and you're talking to a group of people for whom that's a pretty extreme thing to do. You're saying, but you don't understand. It's not that he's a fanatic. There's something else. And yet, at the same time, yeah, there is something different about him. Something different about him. Okay? Yeah.
Stylistically, when he changed his voice, as if she were standing alive before me, it makes me, well, what am I going to get later? I mean, is this narrator going to recede, and we're going to hear a little more first person live action?
Right.
I'm guessing that.
Mm-hmm. And probably not, actually. I mean, the narrator's going to be pretty present. So we are getting things filtered through a narrator. And the narrator is very upfront about, you know, there are things that I can tell you, things I'm guessing at. He says, well, I will give my full opinion beforehand. This is my opinion. I can't claim ultimate truth. And one of the things the novel raises is that question of, can we know ultimate truth? Is everything relative? And there are moments where the novel seems to suggest, yeah, through the narrator, I'm just one human being. And yet the novel also will stake a claim that we can know truth. So it wants it both ways. He was simply an early lover of mankind. You'll see there's a footnote there. Sunita, you're sort of smiling at that. Is that?
Yeah, that's stuck out to me, and I was very curious about that. And
what's
going to come later about it?
Yeah. Well, the footnote indicates that this is a phrase that was used to describe Jesus. Okay, so very quickly, there's some kind of alignment between Alyosha and Jesus. Not that Alyosha is a Jesus symbol or whatever, but there is an alignment there between them. If he threw himself into the monastery path, and even that verb is pretty strong, if he threw himself into the monastery path, it was only because it alone struck him at the time and presented him, so to speak, with an ideal way out for his soul struggling from the darkness of worldly wickedness towards the light of love. Well, that language sounds a little cliched, to my ears at least. It's like, and that verb through, or even at the end of the previous chapter, this description of Alyosha at the top of page 18, that last sentence. Yes, at that time, he'd been living for about a year in our monastery. It seemed he was preparing to shut himself up in it for the rest of his life. Now, there's a narrative voice, right? You get a kind of editorial sense. He's going to shut himself up in it. So there's something, the narrator is somewhat skeptical about this. Alyosha is young. He's 20 years old. And there's some sense at least, yeah, go ahead.
So is the narrator just a priest in the monastery? Is he a leader?
He's a townsperson, as much as we know.
Or is in.
Yeah.
He's not part
of the monastery. No, no. But he seems to know the Karamazovs in that family. Yeah. So Alyosha is young. He's searching for something. And he meets Zosima and in a sense, leaps into the monastery as a solution to the struggle that his soul is having, which is a very serious and very real struggle. Later on, a couple pages later, this is not on your handout, but Dostoevsky comes back to this question about Alyosha. I'll just read this. Some will say that Alyosha was slow, undeveloped, had not finished his studies, and so on. That he had not finished his studies is true, but to say that he was slow or stupid would be a great injustice. I will simply repeat what I've already said. He set out upon this path only because, at the time, it alone struck him and presented him all at once with the whole ideal way out for his soul struggling from darkness to light. Add to this, and this is what I really love, and I love teaching this to 20-year-olds. Alyosha is a 20-year-old. And this is what Dostoevsky adds. Add to this, he was partly a young man of our time. That is, honest by nature, demanding the truth, seeking it and believing in it, and in that belief demanding immediate participation in it with all the strength of his soul, demanding an immediate deed with an unfailing desire to sacrifice everything for this deed, even life. That's the Dostoevsky.
I'm saying this, I've had very little liberal arts, but I was struck by your initial description of the three brothers and the time frame, and I thought superego, ego, and id.
You can certainly do a Freudian reading. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And Freud was fascinated by Dostoevsky, and Dostoevsky's life in his books. I mean, Freud is a generation or so later. And so in these lines, I think you can really hear Dostoevsky affirming these youth. I mean, these are people who are honest and who are seeking truth and are looking. And there's the sense of immediacy, right? You know, it's like, this is my generation. We want the world and we want it now.
Well, we talk about the idealism of
the
vision that there is something better and
you've
got to go for it.
Yeah, and Dostoevsky is honoring that. He is honoring and affirming that. And again, a strong sense of Russia at a crossroads and in a crisis point. And all, I mean, Dostoevsky doesn't live to see it. He dies in 1881, but think, you have the Tsar assassinated by 1905, 25 years later. You've got an aborted revolution, and of course, as we well know, 1917, you've got the Russian Revolution, which sets the stage for Russia throughout the rest of the 20th century. Dostoevsky knew what was coming. He knew that there was some kind of major shift. The question was going to be, where was the country going to go? And this is what he's addressing right here, I think. He then goes on to say, I also love this for college students. There's this unfailing desire to sacrifice everything, even life. Although, unfortunately, these young men do not understand that the sacrifice of life is perhaps the easiest of all sacrifices in many cases. While to sacrifice, for example, 5 or 6 years of their youthful life to hard, difficult studies, to learning, in order to increase tenfold their strength to serve the very truth and the very deed that they loved and set out to accomplish, such sacrifice is quite often almost beyond the strength of many of them. Yeah. Pause there. Listen to the master. All right, so this is Alyosha. And we go back to this passage on pages 18 and 19. Struggling from the darkness into the light. All right. And it's because of meeting this elder Zosima, who is a monk in the monastery and has a strong reputation as a person of wisdom, a person of compassion, a person of love. And he is a healer. So that is who draws Alyosha. And then we get, however, I do not deny that he was. This is that passage, which is very strange. And then, incidentally, I've already mentioned that although he lost his mother in his fourth year, he remembered her afterwards all his life, etc., etc. Now, when you hit the word incidentally, what do you know is about? You hit the word incidentally. What usually follows? Well, if I say incidentally.
Sounds like a digression.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. So
by
I'm telling. Yeah.
By the way.
By the way. Yeah. So I'm telling a story. Right? We're going someplace. And see, a narrative is a path. And Dostoevsky's really interested in the notion of a path. Of course, in Christian terms, we're very familiar with this in the language and the way, the truth, and the life. I mean, Jesus is the way. Jesus is the path. And we know there is a straight way that we are to follow. And we are not supposed to digress. That's where sin lies. And so we are following this straight path. Now, Dostoevsky is telling a narrative that has a path. And we're expecting it to go someplace. Something is going to happen. Why else are we reading this? And you hit the word, oh, incidentally. And then you get, I mean, look how long the paragraph is. And look how long some of these sentences are. And so if we have this staff person who was telling me, you know, I got 300 pages into it, and it was like pulling teeth. Well, you get a paragraph like this, and you can sort of understand it. Where is this going? What is the point here? Incidentally, I've already mentioned, he lost his mother in his fourth year. He remembered her afterwards all his life, her face, her caresses, as if she were standing alive before him. Such memories can be remembered, everyone knows this, even from an earlier age, even from the age of 2. But they only emerge throughout one's life as specks of light, as it were, against the darkness. Now, that language, perhaps, reminds us just a few lines before. We're talking about a movement from dark to light. And so if we're paying attention to what is clearly a digression, we suddenly realize, wait a minute. We're into something pretty significant here. This section that would be very easy to skim, and I find my students, of course, do this all the time. Now, mostly they're looking for dialogue. You can, you flip a few pages and, it's just blocks of print. And they've got 100 pages to read for tomorrow morning. It's 3 a.m. And they've got chemistry homework to do, and their roommate is saying, hey, let's, go out and mess around. And they're just flipping pages. Oh, my gosh. Why did I become an English major? I could be studying organic chemistry. Yeah, this digression. So these memories, are specks of light as it were against the darkness. And the whole notion of memories is going to be crucial in this novel. Memories, Sostoevsky says, are like seeds. Seeds that get planted early in our lives. And again, think of these three generations. And you can do this. This is a good exercise. Sometime later today, just pull out a notebook, or even without writing it, just think, okay, do I have a memory from early life that is like a speck of light in the darkness? And what makes it a speck of light? It would presumably be a memory of love, of compassion, of forgiveness, of being fed, literally or figuratively. Just some moment. It could be so random, and it could be so brief, and yet it's still lodged in your heart. And out of that memory comes a wave of gratitude, a wave of joy, a wave of that sense of being held. That's what Dostoevsky's talking about. That if you have a single memory like that, and we'll see this at the very end of the novel, if you stick around till Friday, this is going to be quite explicit, that there is hope for this next generation. And in fact, that the transformation of the society really comes out of such moments. That we build such moments, we plant such seeds. That's where transformation comes. So that's skipping ahead. This is Alyosha's memory, 4 years old. And here's what he remembers. He remembers a quiet summer evening, an open window, it's the bottom of page 18, the slanting rays of the setting sun, an icon in the corner of the room, a lighted oil lamp. Before the icon, long sentence. On her knees, his mother sobbing as if in hysterics, hugging him and then pleading for him to the Mother of God, holding him out from her embrace with both arms towards the icon as if under the protection of the Mother of God. Well, that's a heck of a memory. So that's Alyosha's memory. And it is a speck of light in the darkness, and the memory itself has to do with light slanting rays of the sun, an oil lamp, and an icon. And so Dostoevsky is also inviting us into 19th century Russia, into Orthodox Christianity, where icons are tremendously important vehicles, vessels, for an awareness of Christ.
The speck of light has a pretty grim ending. Snatched away.
Yes.
And is that, I don't know if that'd be a terrifying memory or a good one.
Well, that's why I wanted to keep reading a little bit farther on, because it seems the nurse sees it as something terrifying, rushes in and snatches him from her in fear. What a picture, says the narrator. And the question is, how are we to respond to this? And then the next sentence, Alyosha remembered it. It was frenzied, but beautiful, as far as he could remember. So it's not, the memory to him is not a memory of trauma. Instead, there is a beauty to it. And of course, what you have is a kind of double, which Dostoevsky also loves. Meaning, you have a mother holding a child, facing an icon of a mother and child. So Alyosha is in some ways in the place of the child Jesus, just as Alyosha's mother is in the place of Mary. Alyosha's mother is as if handing Alyosha over to Jesus and the Mother of God. Yeah.
Was the nurse with CPS? Child Protective Services. It's a motivation for the nurse.
So these days, yeah, you know, that might be the case. That might be the case. Like, oh my God, we're witnessing child abuse.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did the nurse maintain the child when the mother lost the child?
You know what? We never hear anything further about the nurse. And I sometimes thought that would make a good story.
Meanwhile, I didn't break.
And there you go. See? But all threads connect ultimately. You can all bring them back. So that's Alyosha's first memory. We also learn he's lost his mother at the age of 4. And the absence of the mother is really crucial in this story. If we're thinking about the Karamazovs as in some ways representative, the absence of the mother is significant. Russia is Mother Russia. the land is Mother Russia. And there is a disconnection between these people and the land. Dostoevsky had a profound sense of the need, actually, that where Russia was going to regain its soul was with the peasants, with the ones who knew the land, who knew the soil, who knew, in a literal sense, Mother Russia. And out of that literal sense also comes that deeper spiritual sense of the mother, the power of the mother. Mary, Sophia, figure of wisdom, I mean, all of that is contained in the notion of the mother. And that mother is gone, has died. Theodore was married twice, and both mothers have died. And what we learn is that Alyosha, he had been away to school, he came back to his hometown and left school, and he goes to his father, Theodore, and says, I want to go into the monastery. And we learn that this came out of the fact that he had gone back to the town in order to find where his mother was buried. He was looking for the cemetery, and he went to the cemetery. In a sense, he found his mother dead, and then went to the monastery. And so there's a relationship between the absent mother and this hunger for what is apparently, he hopes, will be available through Zosima, who is certainly a kind of alternative father figure, but also a mother figure in life. Yeah.
Well, if it's happening in fairy tales, all good fairy tales, you got to get rid of the mother for the chaos to ensue.
Isn't it true? Isn't it true? And so, I mean, again, one could do all sorts of things, and that would be a fascinating 2-week-long class in and of itself. I mean, I'm quite serious. Think about the fairy tales. The mother is almost always absent. Yeah, and think about those Shakespeare's romances and comedies. It's often fathers and daughters, and the mother's gone. The mother's absent. So there's something about that dynamic that's working here as well.
A lot of mothers die early.
Well, and so yeah, historically that was true. That was true. Now, how much time have we got? Just a couple minutes.
20 seconds.
Yeah.
Okay, we got about 10 minutes. I want to shift to the next section very briefly, which introduces us more to Dmitri and the crisis that is brewing here. The next section, I think page 74, 75 on your sheet, you may have to turn it upside down, is a very Dostoevskian way to put together a packet. You know, one side looks blank, and then you turn it over, and then you got to flip everything upside down. As we will see, that's the way this novel works. What you thought was right side up is actually not. So what is happening is that Dmitri and his father are in a huge quarrel, a legal quarrel over money that Dmitri believes is owed to him and some land that Theodore owns and Dmitri is claiming and so on. And it has been unresolved. And so there was a decision made to take this quarrel to the elder Zosima and to have Zosima function as mediator. And so Dmitri is there, Ivan is there, Alyosha is there, Theodore shows up. So there's this gathering there at the monastery in the cell of the hermit Zosima. The other plot piece here is that Theodore and Dmitri are in love with the same woman, the father and son. So if we're talking Freud, we've got all sorts of juice here. And that woman is named Grushenka. And Grushenka is herself a low woman. That is, she's somebody who has been a kept woman, who has been the mistress of a wealthy man in town. And everybody knows this. And Grushenka is also very smart and very shrewd and has established a certain amount of wealth for herself. And Theodore and Dmitri are both in love with Grushenka and are fighting over her. And all this is coming together as they're there in the monastery. So here's where we're picking up. And Theodore will do anything he can to get Dmitri riled up. He knows how to, you know, the way a parent, if they want to, can, you know, kind of needle a kid. And that's what Theodore is doing to Dmitri. And there's all these statements about duels and fighting and so on. And in the middle of page 74, we have Dmitri saying, why is such a man alive? He's talking about his father. He growled in a muffled voice. Somebody pick up and read the rest of the page for us? We're in the middle of 7-4. We're about 30 minutes out. Thank you.
Now, Dmitry Fyodorovich growled in a muffled voice, now nearly beside himself with fury, somehow raising his shoulders peculiarly, so that he looked almost hunchbacked. No, tell me, can he be allowed to go on dishonoring the earth with himself? He looked around at everyone, pointing his finger at the old man. His speech was slow and deliberate. Do you hear, you monks? Do you hear the parricide? Fyodor Pavlovich flung at Father Yosef. There is the answer to your shame. What shame? This creature, this woman of bad behavior, is perhaps holier than all of you. All of you gentlemen, soul-saving Hyrule monks. Maybe she fell in her youth, being influenced by her environment, but she has loved much, and even Christ forgave her who loved much.
he's just taunting these monks. Right, okay.
Christ did not forgive that kind of love, escaped impatiently from the meek Father Yosef. No, that kind, monks? Exactly that kind, that kind. You are saving your souls here on cabbage, and you think you're righteous? You eat gudgeons, one gudgeon a day, and you think you can buy God with gudgeons? Impossible, impossible, came from all sides of the cell. But the whole scene, which had turned so ugly, was stopped in a most unexpected manner. The elder suddenly rose from his place. Alyosha, who had almost completely lost his head from fear for him and for all of them, had just time enough to support his arm. The elder stepped toward Dmitry Fyodorovich, and having come close to him, knelt before him. Alyosha thought for a moment that he had fallen from weakness, but it was something else. Kneeling in front of Dmitry Fyodorovich, the elder bowed down at his feet with a full, distinct, conscious bow, and even touched the floor with his forehead. Alyosha was so amazed that he failed to support him as he got to his feet. A weak smile barely glimmered on his lips.
And that, forgive me all of you, he said, bowing on all sides to his guests. I find this to be an amazing passage. Again, I love teaching this because here you've got a family quarrel that is also representative of a national quarrel. And you've got somebody who is functioning as a mediator. And how do we expect him to mediate? Well, there's a legal situation here. And at one point, Dmitry almost literally says, you know, gentlemen of the jury, I plead to you. I mean, it's like there is a court case going on here. And you've got a defendant, you've got a prosecutor. And we would expect the mediator to listen to both sides, the way we know a courtroom situation would be. Listen to both sides, take the facts, and evaluate the facts, and draw a rational conclusion as to where the truth lies. That's our anticipation. That's our system of government and law. And Russia was also using that kind of court system. The whole of the final book, 100 pages novel, is a court case. And so this is a foreshadowing of that question. Again, how do we arrive at truth? And how do we arrive at healing out of a place of woundedness? And so Zosima, rather than rationally weighing the pros and cons, weighing the evidence, what does he do? He falls to his knees in front of Dmitry. And I'll often do this in class. I will get on my knees in front of the students and say, forgive me, forgive me. And then I'll say, what does that feel like? And of course, it's unnerving. You know, I'm the authority. And it's you don't know quite what to do about it. But those physical gestures, this is so much a part of the incarnational faith of Christianity. These physical gestures have meaning. Bread, wine, our sacraments are all about being in the body. And this is what Zosima does. He breaks through this impasse by, in a sense, taking on himself everything that he is hearing around me. This is not simply rhetoric. Forgive me, all of you. You know, Fyodor says, What kind of emblem is this? What kind of sign? What's the point here? Zosima actually has entered deeply into Dmitri and Fyodor. He can feel the wounds, and he knows, I am no different than these characters out here. And he feels it so deeply that all he can do is to bow before Dmitri and ask forgiveness. And so this is an entirely different way to try to solve a legal or political dilemma. And of course, it's utterly irrational. It makes no sense whatsoever. Everybody's trying to figure it out. This is very biblical, I think. I mean, Jesus does this all the time in his statements and in his gestures. And people are left, it's like, what did that mean? What did that mean? What's he talking about? But there's this profound experience that's available. It's not something we really have to figure out. We just experience. And so that action of Zosima is the action of a holy person who is, rather than judging, is totally opening himself and placing himself in the place of the one who is wronged. Of course, this is a version of Jesus on the cross. And with the implication that it's only by this kind of gesture that the healing and transformation of society will come. Imagine if everybody were able to do what Zosima does. Because we are, all of us, needing forgiveness. And if we come with that kind of understanding and, in a sense, make ourselves vulnerable that way, we may not be forgiven. That's the notion of vulnerability. The word vulnerable comes from the Latin root wounded, capable of being wounded. And the bowing is very important in Russian society, very important. And so the action of bowing is literally, it's like, I'm exposing, what is it, the phrase, I'm putting my neck on the line.
Oh, right.
Right? I mean, and of course, in old, medieval and the liege lord and so on, that's what you did as a knight. I mean, you bowed and you put your neck on the line. You made yourself vulnerable so that the king can cut your head off if that's what he wishes to do. And so the bow comes out of that kind of position. Complete vulnerability. Implication is that real power actually only comes from that kind of fearlessness, openness, and vulnerability. That's what Zosima is going to model, is a whole different way of transformation. I suspect we're just about out of time.
And Alyosha is at his...
And Alyosha is his disciple, essentially. And that's what we're going to have to track. And tomorrow we will we'll follow Dmitri a little bit further into his story, and we'll get into that passage of the Grand Inquisitor, which means we're gonna meet Ivan as well, the intellectual, who is using his intellect to try to protect himself. And the Grand Inquisitor is his great story of another way to try to solve this problem of the woundedness or the darkness that we're all in. And it's a great story. It's a great story. But even better is Alyosha's response to it. So that's, you got to come back and find out. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And if you have any